Canada's Marxist Revolution continues. Library and Archives Canada is purging offensive and outdated material from its online collection. In British Columbia, one of Canada's premier museums is demolishing iconic exhibits with no replacement plan. And Bill C-67 passes in Ontario's legislature, injecting cultural Marxism and critical race theory into our school curriculums. You are listening to Liberty Dispatch.
Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour.
Bonhoeffer spoke by radio to a national audience. He delivered one of the first public criticisms of the new chancellor.
Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Welcome to Liberty Dispatch, broadcasting across enemy lines into the Canadian culture war. Today, we are glad you're joining us. I'm back in the studio for the first time in a week. I'm linking up with Andrew DiBartolo. It's good to be together on the show. And we want to welcome you, our viewers, once again. We thank you for joining us. If you're watching on Rumble, on our Liberty Coalition Canada channel, you can subscribe there. If you're catching us on podcast, we'd love for you to subscribe or follow the show on your podcast catcher. And please give us a 5-star rating. If you felt half good about the show, give us all the 5 stars. If you hated it, don't lie. Just don't give us a low rating if you don't mind. We would love for your support in that. And keep up with all things Liberty Coalition Canada by subscribing to our email list at libertycoalitioncanada.com. And you can hit a subscribe button there so that you can get everything that we have going out week by week. And finally, we are asking, as we always do, for more Canadians to support financially this institution. We do have ambitious plans to grow our reach and the quality of our programming and reporting so that we can continue to help Canadians think in an orderly and conservative and biblical manner about that which is going around us. And much is changing. And Andrew, it is really good to have you on the show. We're buddies. We've been friends about a year now. Fellow pastors, and I heard you did some awesome work last week with Maddie on the show. Matt's away on vacation now in an undisclosed location. But Andrew, how did last week go? And thanks for being on the show again. Obviously, you have more to say, so thanks for joining me today.
It's great to be doing the show and helping out. Yeah, I had a blast with Matt last week. Interestingly enough, a bunch of people found that my satire was too serious, and they legitimately thought that I was reading the portion of the bill when I was talking about the plot from Captain Planet. So they took that. One person in the comments said, that's not what the bill says. The bill actually says this. And some people thought I played it so straight that they were confused. And so
you're too deadpan, I guess.
I don't know. Yeah. Sometimes I've been accused of being too serious. And apparently when I'm being funny, I'm being too serious. So.
Well, and we have some very sincere listeners, and they happen to trust what we're saying, Andrew. So please don't abuse that trust. Okay. I'm asking that from you for this today's episode. So yeah, it is great. It's great. We have some stories that are going to actually tie into your hometown there in Kingston. But before we get to that, we do want to go over, and this story came to our attention a couple weeks ago. True North Media is reporting that the chief archivist, a Trudeau appointed Leslie Weir, who is the top librarian in Canada, personally ordered all, quote, offensive content to be wiped from archive servers. Employees were told to, quote, flag anything lacking Indigenous perspectives or that ignores or dismisses the impact of colonialism. Much of the content of the Library and Archives Canada website reflects the time in which it was written. This is from Leslie Weir. We understand much of this outdated historical content no longer reflects today's context and may be offensive to many. One of the acting managers of public services, Rebecca Geisbrecht, also stated that the department was scrambling as a result of the order. Leslie had asked us to remove all offensive content from our website, and we are scrambling today to identify what that might be in terms of a rough set of criteria to work with. The result will be that a lot of stuff from our website disappears rather quickly and nothing substantial will be up to replace it immediately, she wrote in a June 8th, 2021 email. This is a continuing trend for Canada's social revolution, as last summer, Prime Ministers biographies pages or biographical pages were deemed redundant, offensive, and were scrubbed from the public record. This is from last summer. Library and Archives Canada actually caught wind of this reporting, Andrew, and they put this up on Twitter last week of March, and they said, quote, "We are making necessary updates and changes to many of our outdated web pages, which are completely separate from our historical collections. Like many interpretive texts written decades ago, older web content does not hold up to today's standards. Many Canadians object to seeing such outdated and imbalanced attitudes on a website of national scope. Web pages are not historical documents and should be updated when times change. This is why we took the step of removing some web pages." So obviously there was an uproar about this, rightfully so. And their response was to say, well, a lot of Canadians, they don't like this imbalanced content.
And so instead of like putting that note, which probably would have been like, that would have been a better play. Like just put that note and just, you know, like they did with the Joe Rogan Spotify episodes. If you're going to do it, just at the beginning, say, listen, we're way more progressive than we were back then. And we've learned so much more than we did back then. We have freed ourselves from the shackles of the patriarchal, Eurocentric, racist, misogynist, transphobic ideas we used to believe, which were unacceptable. Now we've wised up to it. So read this with a grain of salt. Even that's a more reasonable play than just, we're going to erase the past and we're not going to replace it with anything. We're going to pretend that this didn't happen.
Yeah. So that's a great point, Andrew. And something I want to point out is they're talking about removing web pages. So you're talking about interpretive material or biographical material that does not even outdate the internet.
Right.
Like we're talking about perspectives that are so recent, they've been included in web material, web pages. I mean, we're talking about a change at whiplash speed here, that things that we believed less than 30 years ago. I mean, when did the internet become a mainstream access to information in Canada? We're talking about the mid-90s, really.
Yeah.
It was around 10 years before that. But we're talking about mainstream access. We're only talking about less than 30 years here. And they're saying these are outdated. We need to scrub these. We need to move past them. And they don't reflect today's standards. Well, that, I mean, it begs the question, where might we be in another 25 years?
Right. And
if that's the window of change that can be required to scrub historic analysis, gosh, 25 years is not that long from right now. Right.
Well, the two big problems are because it's a two-step thing, right? Step one is determining what is and is not outdated, mm-hmm. which is totally subjective and changes every minute. And then the second step is the removal of that which is deemed outdated, right? And so it's the first step is problematic because whoever defines what is and is not outdated is then going to lead to the second step, which is, okay, let's get rid of it. So at what point does it become outdated to believe, for example, that, oh, I don't know, like men are men and women are women? This is an example, right? When that becomes outdated, then that becomes removed. And so this seems benign, right? This seems like done in favor of, or in an effort to promote or be kind to Indigenous people, various minorities, but it's much more insidious than that. This is a rewriting of history, so to speak.
Well, and that's why I said in my intro there that this is the cultural revolution happening in full color right now. This is not just a matter of updating a textbook to reflect a new discovery. Let's say in biology or something. You know, we're not talking about discovering that the sun is the center of the solar system rather than the earth, and we need to update our textbooks. We're talking about a social construction of the way we understand history and the way we understand our own past that fundamentally differs from the historic Christian sense of history and of progress in general. By what measure do we measure progress? And if we discover in our own past either perspectives or ideas that we no longer value, what do we do with those? Do we leave them open for public record, or do we destroy them? You know, you see these memes on Facebook all the time of photos that Stalin had edited later on in the regime so that he would remove certain characters from the frames within him. And we know that actually Chrystia Freeland, who was photographed with some Ukrainian supporters with a scarf that bore the insignia of a neo-Nazi, quote, far-right party in Ukraine that happened to be fighting for Ukrainian sovereignty. She was photographed with this literal neo-Nazi symbolism, and her tweet was taken down, and she reposted the same tweet with a different photo. I mean, this is the exact mentality of these people. If we make a mistake, if something went wrong, instead of learning from it, instead of teaching upon it or building off of it, it's just wiped. Because we can't bear to look into our past or bear to even acknowledge our mistakes. Or, you know, worse still, heaven forbid, actually glean some wisdom from the past.
Well, because the wisdom that is to be gleaned from the past in this case, or the different elements of wisdom, the different type of wisdoms that will be gleaned from the past in this case, don't actually aid in the pushing of a progressive neo-Marxist agenda. And that's the deal.
Right.
The deal is that the stuff from the past doesn't help. So all this talk about what happened preceding the Second World War, it doesn't actually help us dispel the myths that those are the similar tactics that are being used by elites now. And so we don't want people to think about what those led to 70 years ago. Hmm. So let's just forget that, because we certainly don't want people to awaken to the reality of what's happening now. We'll just forget it. And it doesn't fit the agenda. And that's why we got to erase it.
Well, and I'm just looking at one of the quotes here that True North reported on from when these biographical pages were brought down. And by the way, you think that they're just trying to erase maybe sort of far right or conservative? I mean, you look at the prime minister's pages that were taken down from Archives Canada: John Turner, Joe Clark, Kim Campbell, Jean Chrétien, and Pierre Elliott Trudeau. These are pages that were brought down, scrubbed, and deleted from their archives. And a spokesperson said, quote, "Unfortunately, it does not always reflect our diverse and multicultural country, often presenting only one side of Canada's history. Library and Archives Canada acknowledges that some of its online presence is offensive and continues to correct these issues." I mean, you have to hear the ominous promise in that statement. We will continue to correct these issues.
Yeah, we have a big eraser.
Yeah.
We're going to use it.
And by what standard? We don't know. So it's like carving through a cornfield and finding the rotten stalks and taking them down. Only you don't know, is it by whose standard? Who gets to decide whose perspectives are relevant or abiding and whose are no longer acceptable? And Andrew, I wanted to, and we're going to follow up a little bit more on this, but I want to jump again to our second story, which is this dismantling of a museum display in British Columbia. Now, this work is already done. This story came across my attention around Christmas time. It ran in the National Post, December 23rd, 2021, Tristan Hopper. And I'm so thankful for this article that he ran, because this really arrested me. This really caught me in my tracks and kind of put me upright as I read it. Canada's premier museums is deconstructing iconic exhibits in the name of decolonization in British Columbia. Tristan Hopper writes, "The Royal British Museum, called by the Frommer's Travel Guide, quote, hands down one of the world's best regional museums, is having its most signature attractions being abruptly ripped out in the name of decolonization. The work began," now I'm speaking retroactively, the work did begin on January 2nd to demolish life-size dioramas of a Peace River homestead, a salmon cannery, a Vancouver Island coal mine, and HMS Discovery, the flagship of British explorer George Vancouver. Most notable of all, crews will be ripping out Old Town, the museum's walkthrough recreation of a BC community at the turn of the century, lining a model street paved with authentic wooden cobblestones, are a grand hotel, a blacksmith shop, a movie theater, screening Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush, and a railway station where special effects are used to simulate the arrival of trains. It makes me want to go there. It sounds incredible.
This sounds so triggering, Tim. I'm so sorry. I'm like trigger warning. I can't even.
Is it the cannery? Because I sort of
shudder. You know what it was? Honestly, yeah. That, it's funny you say that. I saw the salmon cannery, and all I could think about was salmon. It doesn't look like it because my camera has really good tech, but I'm literally shaking.
Right.
Yeah, now, good stabilizer. The salmon cannery.
Yeah. So and the arrival of trains, right? So there's an interesting quote here from Victoria-born travel writer Lucas Aykroyd. He writes, he said, "World-class museums rarely disassemble their galleries without releasing a plan, budget, or timeline of what will replace them," he said in a column for the Daily Hive. And in this case, this happened very abruptly. It was given a 2-week window, and there are no, at the time of writing, there were no plans to replace this these displays. A final report issued in October of 2019 to the museum did not recommend anything close to a full-scale gutting of the museum's human history galleries. Rather, First Nations mainly wanted a place where their names would be spelled correctly, which I think is fair. If you're going to be included in the historic record, you should get their names right. Okay.
Right.
And that their culturally items would be displayed with respect and their history would be represented as dynamically as it was for white British Columbians. I think that's great. If you're going to revise some of your displays and change the lighting or whatever, there are things that you can do in a museum to improve your displays. Absolutely. In this report, apparently, gave these suggestions. Whereas writing for or speaking on behalf of the museum, Troy Sebastian,
and this isn't an Indigenous person, right? This is
correct. This would be Troy Sebastian.
A white guy. All right.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, curator of the Indigenous collections, which sounds mighty colonial, if you ask me. Also, he resigned in the middle of all this because I think these people can't even stand participating in these institutions. I think the whole concept of a museum to them is probably offensive. Troy Sebastian, curator of the Indigenous collection, also resigned while calling the museum a wicked place. And he said, quote, "The truth is that the Royal BC Museum is established as a bastion of white supremacy, whose Indigenous collections are a gargantuan repository of trauma and violence," he wrote on Twitter. The vitriol for the museum continued in the lips of the current CEO, Daniel Muzica, who said that the RBCM is a product of systematic racism that was both a racist, anti-Indigenous, and colonial space, as well as a sexist and psychologically unsafe space for women.
I would like to note for our listeners, viewers, so just so we're clear, my comments not that long ago about being triggered and shaking, just so we're clear, I actually didn't read or didn't know those quotes you were going to read. So it wasn't like I anticipated that you were going to be reading these quotes where people were talking about the psychological effect and the trauma. I didn't know that. And so my comments about the triggering and the shaking
don't seem so satirical.
Well, it was just, oh yeah, this, but like, really? That's madness.
It's utter madness. It is. So we just, before we really get deep into the weeds of analysis, this is lunacy.
Yeah.
This is unhinged mental illness. Okay. In the name of quote, cultural sensitivity. Okay. This is what this is. This is utter academic drivel that has real world applications that are utterly bonkers. They are destroying museums that represented the time frame that they claim to. These are dioramas and artifacts and cultural settings that are literally there to relive what is no longer there. They are museums. Okay, yeah. They're there to observe things about the past. This is what we were saying about the websites. Rather than glean from them or update them slightly, or change the displays or change the order of how you walk through a room, or perhaps add material that maybe better reflects some analysis from Indigenous perspectives of the time, or maybe adding some oral tradition there that you know, whose perspective was lacking. What do? They gut it. And they call it a psychologically unsafe space for women. What? How? Has any woman ever gone through there and left a note in the visitor feedback section? I felt psychologically unsafe as I walked through the cobblestone.
Well, maybe in the last couple of years. Theater. Maybe someone has in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and this, so there's a thread, right?
Yeah.
The first story, this one, and the next one.
Absolutely.
And what we're seeing here is, and you're right to ask the question, by what standard? Because the question is, or what they're addressing is, we have determined with enough passage of history that this particular worldview or this particular idea of civilization or culture, we now look back and we say that it is evil and racist and misogynist. And they look back and it's ahistorical, really, because mm-hmm. they look back and what they say is all of this Western white Eurocentric culture that they just decided they were going to take over the world and wipe out everyone else who didn't think like them and look like them and act like them, which if that was the goal, they failed, because clearly we still value very much differences in ethnicities and demographics. And that's part of what enriches the human experience. But in any event, they look back and they say, we have now deemed that this culture bad and this culture good. And rather than highlighting that and giving reasons for it, we're just going to pretend like this didn't happen, because all that's going to do is show us what we don't want to deal with, which would be something like, maybe there were benefits, for example, to certain advancements in medicine, technology, culture, literature, that have been brought about by certain people from a certain part of the world. They're good. No, we're just going to erase. We're going to forget that altogether. We want nothing good that they've done. All we want to do is highlight how bad they are. And they're redrawing the lines. They're setting up a new post, right? They're creating a new standard for what's good and what's right. And there anything that doesn't meet that standard, let's get it out, period.
Right. And so this is why the approach is basically a giant eraser or a giant crowbar, right? You're not bringing nails and wood to the job site here. You're bringing a bulldozer and a crowbar. And because you can't even be seen to be preserving any of that testimony. You can't be seen to be in any way giving sympathy to these perspectives, because they are, quote, outdated. They've already been relegated to the heap, right? To the dustbin. You have to destroy it. Otherwise, you get sucked into the vortex of an outdated colonialist, white supremacist, misogynist. Sorry, what else was in this list? You know, traumatizing, yep. just
violent, insane. Psychologically paralyzing.
Yes. No. So, and this is not to say, and I've studied Canadian history, American history. I know you have, Andrew, and nobody is saying that violence didn't take place, or that, you know, unfair deals didn't go down, or that, you know, underhanded things took place between people groups. Nobody would deny that. But the historic record is fairly reliable, and not to say that, and failing to recognize that the very people who are telling us that these things were, you know, irredeemably wicked, and he literally called it a wicked place, are the same people who will tell you to place your ultimate trust in the perspectives that they're offering. You need to trust us completely with the renewal of culture and the renewal of society and the remaking of the cultural narrative. You need to trust our perspective. We have it right. How colonial does that sound? Right. You're talking about, people are saying, we know the answers, we know the way forward, and your perspectives no longer matter. This is, I mean, it's ideological genocide going in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And if it happened, I'm saying, in ideological genocide, which, by the way, is not inherently wrong. We're not talking about genocide of people, but of ideas. Certain ideas should die. Certain worldviews should perish. And I'm not making any comment about which ones at this point. But if it cut in that direction and it was inherently wrong, that every worldview is equal, they should all be, well, you know, equally respected and equally heeded, then how is that not going on right now in the other direction?
Right.
To say, we're going to whitewash this, we're going to erase this, we're going to destroy this perspective because it's represented by people with the wrong skin tone.
Right.
And this might sound like a lot of, you know, fear mongering on our part, but I want Andrew to take us through a little bit of this Ontario bill, and then we're going to finish with a bit of analysis that kind of brings them all together. But Andrew, tell us what's going on in Ontario.
So in Ontario, we have Bill 67, which is the Racial Equity in the Education System Act, or as I like to call it, the Get Your Kids the Heck Out of Government Schools as Fast as You Possibly Can Act, before they're indoctrinated to be a bunch of little Marxists. But that's too long of a title, so the shorter one is better. The act has received its second reading in the Ontario legislature, which means there's only two steps left before this thing actually becomes law and receives royal assent in Ontario. And this bill purports to promote and advance anti-racism and racial equity. And we'll unpack what those mean or how they're defined in a little bit, specifically in the education system. So this is both in terms of resources for curriculum and extracurricular material, but also includes training staff and disciplining those, both teachers and students, who don't do everything in their power to advance anti-racism and work toward racial equity in schools. So I want to read from the bill itself the definitions they offer of anti-racism and racial equity. Anti-racism and racism, right? Because you got to know what racism is if you're going to be anti-racism. So this is what it says. Anti-racism means the policy of opposing racism, including anti-Indigenous racism, anti-Black racism, anti-Asian racism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. Now, I would note two things. One, the absence of anti-white racism or anti-Anglo racism, because that's totally acceptable. After all, they are the oppressors and the privileged patriarchs and misogynists and racists over time. So that's fine. I'll also like to note, just by way of clarification, Islam is not a race. It is a system of beliefs. And you have people across the ethnic spectrum, including lower melanin count people
Muslims. Wouldn't it be nice if in our Ontario legislature, our MPPs understood the difference between a race or an ethnicity and a religion?
Yeah. Or a boy and a girl.
Too much to ask? Islam is not a race.
Right.
Like the stupidity at the very core of this, right, is just screaming for attention. But anyway,
it's just everything so white bad, right? That everything's so white bad, Christian bad. That's what this comes down to. So that's how they define anti-racism.
Correct.
And racism, they say, means the use of socially constructed ideas of race to justify or support, whether consciously or subconsciously, right? You don't even know you're racist, but you might be. The notion that one race is superior to another. Now, I think we can agree, Tim, you and I, and anyone who's reasonable, that if you believe that any particular ethnicity is inherently inferior than another simply because of the color of their skin or where they come from, that's an evil belief. We can all agree on that. And we can also agree that showing partiality to people, positively or negatively, because of the color of their skin or the country from which they come, is also an evil practice. This could be thoughts, this could be words, this could be actions. We cannot support this kind of partiality. We can't look at this and say, oh yeah, that's good, that's righteous. It's evil. But that's not what this bill is about. It uses a lot of flowery language and euphemism. That's not what the bill is about. Not at all. This bill elevates the principles of anti-racism and racial equity. Now, anti-racism, really quick, as defined by Ibram X. Kendi, who's the author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, is someone who is expressing an anti-racist idea or supporting an anti-racist policy. Now, some of our viewers might not be familiar with the idea of anti-racist. They might be accustomed to, you know, kind of reasonable understanding of, I'm not a racist. Like, that should be enough. I'm not a racist and I don't do racist things, but that's not good enough. You have to be an anti-racist, which means you have to actively oppose racism with your actions, with your words, with your thoughts. It's activism. right? Anti-racism is about activism. And the goal of anti-racism is not to end racism, because ultimately people are always going to think and do and believe evil things, or you can't make someone unracist, nor can you eliminate the sin of partiality from the earth altogether. The goal of anti-racism, and really this is what the goal of the bill is. The goal of the bill is racial equity, which is another euphemism. Racial equity doesn't actually mean what it says or what people believe. And so equity sounds a lot like equality, but it's not the same thing. Equity is not equality. Equity isn't treating people the same in terms of equal dignity and worth and value because they're image bearers of God. That's not what equity is. Equity is about equal outcomes or no disparities for people, none. If there are any disparate outcomes, if there's any differences in terms of wealth, in terms of education, in terms of where they live, where they go to school, incarceration rates, if there's any difference whatsoever, that is inequitable, and it's probably because of racism. And so racial equity means doing whatever you have to do through both policies and coercion to ensure that there are no disparate outcomes across ethnic lines. And yes, that sounds like communism, because it is. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and Andrew, I just want to point out two things. Number one, we talked about how a worldview that would inherently disparage any ethnic group, let's say a skin color or a language region or anything like that, any cultural distinction, to show somebody and treat somebody thusly with prejudice, with negative prejudice, even positive prejudice, that view is not supported by Darwinism, okay? Which Darwinism is what we have accepted wholesale as a society about the origin of where we came from. Charles Darwin himself was a classic racist, okay? He spoke of the hierarchy of races, which should not be a surprise, was adopted by Nazi Germany when they produced the hierarchy of races, when they justified expansion of their land for the superior race, for living space. So that's Darwinism, and our society seems to have no problem accepting that, okay? And then the second thing I want to point out is that when you speak of partiality and racism, and you mentioned how anti-white or anti-Anglo racism was not mentioned in that. And there's an important reason for that. It's not just because people are openly saying, yeah, it's fine to be racist to white people. There's actually an ideology behind that Ibram X. Kendi himself teaches and perpetuates. And that is that showing partiality, negative partiality, is acceptable in the cases when you are working towards an equitable outcome.
Right.
So if you have a black man and a white man apply for the same job, and the white man is more qualified, if he happens to so be, he's more qualified or he's more gifted in or has more experience in the job. The black man is also good. He's competent, but the better hire would be the white person, let's say, not because he's white, but because of his resume and his skills. Ibram X. Kendi would say, and the ideology behind this would say, to show partiality to the black man and to actually to prejudice your decision against the white man is actually a just decision. Mm-hmm. It is a fair decision. It is partiality that is producing an equity of outcome, which is that the black man would receive a job because he is black, and at the white man's expense, that's actually good, because historically they're saying that's an action of anti-racism. That's right. How you be anti-racist. You put the white man down because he has always enjoyed the historic benefits of racism. So now it's time for the tides to turn.
Right.
Okay. And the hypocrisy of all of this is rank, because Justin Trudeau subscribes to this whole ideology. He did, even way back when he was elected, and he created a 50-50 parity cabinet where he prized the gender or the sex of a person over their qualifications, which is rank unprofessionalism and actually dangerous when you're talking about running a country. And when a reporter asked him, why do you insist on having gender parity in your cabinet? His answer was, because it's 2015.
Right.
Because it would be historically outdated not to have equal representation of men and women. It's purely based on chronology and keeping up with the times. And what I always fail to understand is, then why has he not resigned and given the post to a female?
because the same reason why for the same reason about that curator at the museum,
right?
Because there's so many levels to this, and it brings up the idea of, you know, either the white savior complex or the soft bigotry of low expectations. It's as if to say, right, here are all these problems that have faced ethnic minority communities. Well, they can't fix it. Here's what they're actually saying. Here are all the problems they faced, but guess what? They can't fix it themselves. They're not able to pick themselves up.
A white person has to get in. Yeah.
Me. It needs to be me that saves them. This is the irony and the hypocrisy of it. And I mean, Kennedy himself said that discrimination is wrong unless it's discrimination against the oppressor.
Right.
But you bring up our prime minister. We've seen this in the last 2 years, because a BLM march that is against supposed injustice against a group of people based on their race or ethnicity, that kind of protest is acceptable. But a protest by a bunch of blue collar truckers against a civil government that very much so has been oppressive and tyrannical, that's not acceptable. That's right. Not acceptable.
And for those who are for the multicultural representation that was in the protest, that gets ignored, because we were both there. There was no difference in the cultural cross spectrum in the protest than any other day in the city. There were brown people, Muslims, Christians, there were New Age people, white, Asian and Chinese and Korean and Indian, and it was just a wild spectrum, Sikhs, all kinds of everything. But that gets ignored because I'm going to get back to the bill, because we don't want to talk about the fact that it's in schools, not just the ideology, but those people don't count. This is what's hilarious. Just get a pen ready for this. If you're listening and you want to remember something insane about this ideology and why you should reject it and why you need to get yourself out of any institution that holds to this. If you are brown or black or in any kind of minority, visible skin minority, then you don't count as a black person unless you subscribe to the worldview that white people are inherently oppressors. So you can look at all of the multicultures that were in that protest. They didn't count as multiculturalism or as non-racist, because they were, in the view of this ideology, imbibing whiteness.
Right.
They were imbibing whiteness in the cause that they took up. So if you're a Sikh man who drives a truck and you just want to be allowed to do your job without vaccination requirements, you are actually embodying a white ideology. Advancing white supremacy.
Right.
This is what's amazing about this ideology, is there's no escape from it. Okay. Leslie Weir, as you pointed out, is very obviously white, but you don't see in her speaking any sense that what she's saying might be a product of whiteness, because what she's saying is, I can escape my whiteness, but you can't. Okay. And that's what this ideology teaches. And so, Andrew, tell us about why getting into schools is such a big concern for Canadians with this ideology, and what kind of people this produces, which is a scary thought, but take us there.
Right. And I'll say again here, which I kind of said in jest a little bit not that long ago, and I might say one, maybe two more times before we're done. And this might be controversial. I'm not usually prone to saying controversial things.
I mean, it's true. Very safe.
Yeah. Right. So, but I'll say it anyways, just in general, but specifically among believers, you have to get your kids out of government schools, full stop. Like, that's it. I can't make it work. Make it work. You can make it work. You can work a part-time job and you can work a part-time job, homeschool your kids, have a house, have two vehicles, and not be burrowing yourself into debt, but working the other way. I know it's possible. Personally, get your kids out of government schools, period. So with that in mind, and I'll say that again, it'll upset some people. That's too bad. So the bill offers, by way of actually advancing racial equity, these practices or these ideas, quote, They want to establish and provide annual professional development programs to educate teachers and other staff of the board about promoting racial equity and developing the necessary tools to address racism. And for anyone who gets lost in that flowery language, that's just a fancy way of saying re-education and propaganda for teachers. Okay, that's what that is. Quote, every board shall establish a racial equity plan for the schools of the board and require its schools to implement the plan. So this isn't even like a school can make your decision, right? You're a school, you have to have a racial equity plan that is acceptable and you have to put it into place. This is later on in the bill. Quote, at least one member, so this is in two different sections, it's the exact same wording that's repeated, so I'm just going to combine them because they're referring to different boards or different groups. So at least one member of the Higher Education Quality Council or the Ontario Colleges Board shall be a person who has expertise in racial equity in the post-secondary education sector or in the high school education sector, someone who's an expert in
other
racial
words,
equity.
In other words, a degree in underwater basket weaving. So right. Continue.
Someone who's read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo and has understood that they have to decouple themselves from whiteness, they're an expert, basically. Quote, if the minister learns, so you have the person who's been appointed, right? This, at least this one person has to be an expert. Quote, if the minister learns upon conducting an investigation or otherwise, read inquisition, that a member of the council or the board does not have a proven commitment to racial equity in the post-secondary education sector, i.e. they're not an ally and they're not doing everything they can to advance anti-racism, the minister shall require that member to take anti-racism training within the following 6 months. Read again, 6 month re-education camp. That's what that is here. So let's put this together, because I mean, the bill itself is fairly long and there's lots of little mini additions. And basically they'll say, you know, and in this section add racial equity, or in this section add advancing anti-racism. So the page is kind of convoluted, but we have to put this together in a way so that people understand what's actually going on here. We're cutting through the euphemisms and the fancy terms. This is what's happening. The Ontario legislature wants to make law that we must re-educate teachers and indoctrinate students at every level of government school, every level, top to bottom, post-secondary down to kindergarten, to believe that they must do everything in their power to actualize the neo-Marxist goal of equal outcomes across every demographic line. And so that's a problem, but the solution or the means is just as problematic, which is that we must employ critical race theory to see that dream come true. And we have to punish anyone, student or teacher, who doesn't actively buy into that satanic agenda. That's what this bill's about.
And that quote that you just brought up for us, that if they learn that one of the members does not have a proven commitment to racial equality in the post-secondary education sector, shall require that member to attend re-education. That chill has to go into your bones when you read this. Do you think this is about building a brighter and more prosperous future? Does a bill like this sound like a bright future for Ontario? This is the legalization of ongoing witch hunts. Mm-hmm. What does a proven commitment look like? It means, for one, scanning your social media back to its inception. Okay, so if you plan to go anywhere with this, if you want to get in the ladder and you want to advance in these boards and you want to become these people, I suggest you shut down and scrub your social media now. Okay, start with that, because I guarantee you, if Facebook launched in 2004, 2006, or 2007 or something,
yeah, something like that,
you're going to want to go back. And because whatever you did, going back to Leslie Weir, whatever you posted 10 years ago, I guarantee you does not hold up to today's standards. So there's your first suggestion, is go scrub your social media because you're not getting out alive from that. What else does proven commitment look like? They're going to go back through your hiring records. They're going to go back through what schools you went to. Where did you get your degree? What did your professor, what views did your professors hold when you got that degree? Are they sufficiently anti-racist? Okay, because if you learn from people who are not sufficiently committed to anti-racism, then you're down the tubes there. What did you do while you were in university? Did you ever belong to a frat house? Did you ever belong to a fraternity? Okay, or a sorority? Because that's going to be problematic. Okay, because that's not sufficiently anti-racist. What's the diversity level of the clubs that you participated in? What about your rowing team? Hey, what about your class photos?
Show us proof. Can you show us proof that you were at the BLM rally? Because that's going to get you the job, right? Show us picture proof that you were at the BLM rally. And you know what? You might get the job above this other person who didn't attend.
Exactly. Yeah. You're talking about a full-scale surrender of your thought autonomy and of your social autonomy. You're talking about a complete surrender to an ideology that demands total allegiance. This is religious devotion that outstrips anything I've seen in my lifetime in terms of things that went on around me as a Christian. This is totalitarianism guised with this language of equity. Okay, you need to hear that as you said, a satanic agenda. This is what it is. It's the destroyer of lies. It's the lives. It's the destroyer of freedom and liberty. And you know, and we're not just reacting to it. I mean, Andrew, you brought up some great scriptures here to kind of correct where this takes us in terms of how we view justice and equity and righteous activity. Well, I mean, how should we live if we can't live in a world where we're chasing our own tails, trying to prove our commitment to equity? What is the way forward if you're thinking biblically and if you want to live in a way that is truly just and impartial?
Well, this is a thread definitely woven throughout all of these stories, is that what part of what grounds these endeavors is critical theory. So not critical race theory, not you include the critical gender theory, but critical theory itself, which ultimately is a way of viewing reality and specifically literature. And so critical theory is kind of built on the premise that if you're reading a book, for example, and the author writes certain things, literary theory is about reading what the author wrote. It's about trying to understand the context, not only of the author, but of the material. What's the context of the story? What's going on? Have we seen certain things in the story, certain clues, certain consistent themes, in trying to understand what's actually going on? That's literary theory. Critical theory is different. One of the goals of critical theory is, what is the author saying by what he's not saying? So what we need to do is read between the lines and try to understand from the silent bits what's actually going on. And critical theory has with it the goal of deconstruction, right? Of deconstruction and dismantling. And so this idea of erasing the past, of erasing structures, of tearing down Western civilization, this is a goal in all of this. In all of these things, this is the agenda, is to tear down these principles, these values, these cultural norms, and these realities, and these creational biblical realities as well. We're supposed to tear them down, take them apart, forget they happened, and move on. And that is thoroughly unbiblical. And it's not the way that Christians are to live and operate. And I would say, by the way, that the part of the irony is what we're seeing now with canceling and erasing the past and removing these archives because we don't want to deal with them in the present. The sad truth is it's the Christian church more broadly that modeled this years and years ago when they started decoupling the Old Testament from the New Testament, right? When they said stuff like, ooh, those passages in the Old Testament, those are problematic.
They don't hold up to today's standards.
That God, yeah, what he says about sexuality, what he says about women, that's just outdated. And so we, Christians, we showed the world how to take things in our past, take a part of our ancestry and erase it. We showed them that. And we modeled for them what it means to be ashamed of stuff in the past and then make it seem like it doesn't apply. So with that in mind, to the shame of the church, what we're going to do is we're going to see, well, what did the scriptures actually say? How are we supposed to understand what we're supposed to do? Well, when we're talking about the idea of equity, about equal outcomes, about partiality being shown, right? Like you can be racist against the oppressor. You can show discrimination against the privileged and the oppressor. This is what the scriptures has to say about it. So this is Leviticus 19, verse 15. You shall do no injustice in court, which we agree with the social justicians in principle. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. We see a similar idea in Exodus 23, verses 1 to 2. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit siding with the many so as to pervert justice, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit, right? Real equality or real justice biblically is applying God's law evenly across spectrums. It's taking the law of God. It's taking the rules and principles and commands and moral statutes of the Lord and applying them evenly and saying, we're not going to see special treatment because you're rich, you're poor, you're white, you're black, you're male, you're female. No, we're going to apply his law and his standards evenly across all. And the understanding is that it is ultimately the Lord in his providence and in his sovereign care of the world that puts people where he does, right? So we read this in 1 Samuel 2, 6 to 7. This is Hannah's prayer because the Lord has determined that he will bless her with a child, even though she's been barren. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. God is sovereign over creation. And what we see is that he is the one who makes people born with certain tendencies, certain abilities, certain privileges. Like I was privileged to be born, not in a white family, but I was privileged to be born in a family that had both a mom and a dad. I was privileged to be born in a country with the advancements in medicine and technology. But there are people who, not because of any fault of their own, were born in other places or were born without these same privileges or abilities. And what we're not supposed to do is kind of overcorrect and do super justice to try to make everything even, right? We're trying to be God. We're trying to say, we don't like what he's done. Let's just flatten it all out and make it fair and even across the board. But in order to do that, it means you need to show partiality, positively or negatively, to various people.
You failed to mention the privilege of Italian folk music that you were born into.
It is a privilege, okay? I will say.
And it's a privilege that I hope you'll share with our viewers one day. But I don't know, was it Winston Churchill who said communism is the equal sharing of miseries?
You cannot
achieve these outcomes without destruction of property.
Right.
And disinheriting people. And you see, that's what happens in a socialistic utopian society. You end up disinheriting people of what is rightfully theirs or their children's. That you see, we have inheritance tax, we have income tax, we have every way to enforce economic redistribution, that it's unjust for you to earn a certain level, or it's unjust of you to hold the job you do because you probably achieved it because of your whiteness or your Italianness. Okay, so the
I'm triggered again.
Yeah. that's my microaggression.
Yeah.
So what these scriptures that you just shared tell us, Andrew, is that your background, whether economic, ethnic, all of those things, they are not to be factored in when evaluating your either your guilt before the law, mm-hmm, or your innocence before the law, or the merits of your skills or your preparedness to do a job or your achievements in a given task. All right. So when you lower the standards for women for the firefighting test, you are not producing equity Okay. You are producing an uneven standard.
Right.
You or I would not argue that a woman should not have the right to go be a firefighter per se. What we would argue against is that the standard for a firefighter would be lowered for somebody of a different ethnic or sexual background.
And if she can't pull me out of a fire, she shouldn't be a firefighter. Just as an example, if she can't drag a full size. So that's what I mean. That creates an unsafe. Right now, our fire department is less qualified and it's more unsafe because they're not able to do the job that's actually required of them.
Not because they have allowed a woman, but because they have allowed somebody to do a job that they were not previously qualified for until the standards were dropped. So this is why communism is the equal sharing of misery. Mm-hmm. Because you cannot raise everybody up. So what you must do is bring everybody down. And just as we close here, Andrew, a couple thoughts I'd love to get from you. But in my estimation, and when I read this story about the museum, I really said to myself, I said to my wife, we are in the late stages of a cultural revolution at this point. We are committing cultural suicide, not homicide or genocide. We are literally destroying our own culture, our own foundations. Because in my mind, what future does a country have that blows up and demolishes its past? Mm-hmm. What are the principles going forward that we're going to build social unity around? How are we going to rebuild our institutions? When they say all of this retraining for educators and students, what are the principles? And will they be acceptable in 10 years? We have nothing that we can count on to actually build a future that is reliably rational and fair and free. There's nothing there. There is, and I want to share this quote that you, I think, so wisely put into our outline here, Andrew. And it's a famous quote from George Orwell, his book, 1984. He said, every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. And the process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. Isn't that what Leslie Weir said? We have much work to do. The process continues day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. The past was erased and the erasure was forgotten and the lie became the truth. This is what's scary, is that right now we are watching it happen. What happens in a generation where we don't know, our children don't know that it was erased? At least right now, we have the cultural memory to say, wow, we better keep our books. Don't take your books to the Salvation Army, by the way, people, especially if it's written by Pierre Trudeau or about him, because apparently those are being erased. Mm-hmm. So hang on to your books, and I'm not kidding, because we are seeing this happen and play out. But what happens in the generation after? They don't remember this phase. They don't remember this process of the Cultural Revolution. And all they have access to are the lies, the censorship, the whitewashing, the retelling, the renaming, the hiding of statues. Your hometown, John A. McDonald's statue was pulled into storage.
Right.
Why? So you grew up in Kingston. From now on, there's no statue. There's no remembrance of your history. There's no remembrance of the accomplishments. It's just gone. And you'll see the billboard on the 401. You'll see his name taken down. I think it said, was it birthplace of John A. McDonald?
As soon as you come into Kingston.
You'll see that torn down. And that cultural memory, slowly over time, the sands of this revolution will be washed away. These waves crashing and just bringing everything down and swallowing it into the sea of this revolution. And I don't know how else to interpret this. You are really seeing the foundations being blown out. And that's, how do you rebuild institutions from there? Where do you go when this is the aim of your culture?
And they don't want us to know about and learn from what happened in order to be equipped for the future. So there's a reason why that most people, most either, you know, Holocaust survivors, or even Jews nowadays, based on polls and based on conversations, they're not the ones who are calling for the closure of Holocaust memorials and the erasure of what happened. People are saying we need to forget about it. But the reason why they would say, no, don't close down the memorials, don't close the museums, don't take all this down. And their justification is because we can't forget what happened if we're going to move forward with the knowledge and with the understanding. And so part of is erasing the past, part of dismantling the past and taking down these structures is so that we don't remember what happened, so that we don't see the present play, right? So that we don't understand that what's going on is more of the same thing that's happened over and over and over again. Because we can rewind all the way back to the first century and we can see that Nero rewrote history with regards to who set the fires in Rome. And the reason why he did that is so that he could set his sights on the Christians and use them as a scapegoat so that he himself could burn down the city to rebuild his temple. And so you change history, you change the narrative, and someone's got to suffer because you have an agenda. And that agenda is, in truth, the agenda is always self-serving. This has been happening for thousands of years. This isn't a new thing. And believers need to understand, Christians who are biblically minded, politically minded, we're not people who erase or forget history. Even the very ugly spots of history, even the blemishes, even the truth that some of the greatest evangelical Christian minds, for example, had slaves. We're not just going to gloss over that. We're not going to gloss over the fact that Edwards had slaves. We're not going to forget it and pretend it didn't happen. What we're going to do is we're going to learn from it. We remember these things. We recall these things that happened, the events that transpired, because in part, there are moments where we can see the providence of God at work, but it also allows us to learn and grow and be prepared for the future. I want to read a passage from Joshua here quickly, chapter 4. So this is as they're about to step into the land. And right once they step into the land, their journeying is done, right? The wandering in the desert is done. They're in the land. They establish themselves. They build a temple. They allot the land. They give out to the different tribes what they have. And so you would think, forget about the journeying. That's not important. We have the new land. We're finally here. And so this is what Joshua says to them, starting in verse 5. Pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each one of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time, right? Because they're going to ask, what happened before? Where did we come from? How did we get here? Where were we before we were here? What do these stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. That's how we operate as believers. We understand the past. We learn from it. We don't do corporate repentance for sins we didn't commit. We understand what happened. We learn from it. We see God's providential hand at work. And when we see similar plays happening in our world, when we see elected officials, health officials, elites, we see even in a globalist agenda, similar plays to what's happened, a similar playbook, you know, to steal from Solzhenitsyn, we don't live by lies. We understand what's true and we move forward with the knowledge of what's happened in the past. We can't be dismantling and deconstructing. That is not right. Revolution is not a Christian principle. It Correct. Has never been.
Correct. And just on that, I think that's a brilliant way to close, Andrew, that deconstruction is not the path forward. It's being presented as such that we need to, you know, we need to decouple our whiteness. We need to decolonize our museums and our bookshelves and, you know, erase this whole notion of bias and all these things. But in the first two stories, and actually in the third as well, it's just not stated explicitly. In the first two stories about the web pages in the museum, it is noted that there are no plans or no concrete, there's no concrete vision for what's going to replace it. That could not be a better metaphor for what this decolonization and deconstruction stuff actually does to a culture. There is no future. They have no plans to replace it because you know why? They know that in less than 25 years, it's going to be deemed racist and colonist and misogynist and triggering and wicked and all the other things by their successors who will become progressively more wise and woke and, you know, elitely aware of their own bias. So there's nothing they can do. So all they can do is erase. All they can do is destroy. All they can do is void. And then it leaves in our future a dim and depressing and bleak and lifeless future, because it will become a perpetual witch hunt in which you are constantly signaling your virtuous participation in the program. That, I mean, if you think this is going to stay in schools, that this is just for the Board of Education, that you have to demonstrate that you're an ally, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen those stickers on the shops of the trans flag and the gay pride flag? Remember when it went from the simple rainbow flag to the one with the triangles, and now it's
the inclusive flag?
Those symbols are signals of your participation as an ally. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think this stuff is going to be connected with smartphones and with your job in general, wherever you work and your social media, this is where this all goes. It's going to be a perpetual demonstration of your allegiance to the cause. It is the destruction of free thought and debate and idea exchange. This is an endless present in which the party is always right. And you know what? Proverbs 22:28 states it so simply: do not move the ancient landmark set by your forefathers. Okay? Learn from them. The Bible doesn't whitewash the past of our ancestry. We see all the sins on full display of Christianity's greatest examples. Not as examples to follow, but as sins to avoid and pride to avoid. We have adulterers and prostitutes and incest and all manner of vile wickedness from our own ancestors that failed in those moments to walk in the faith. But their stories are with us, okay, in order that we might build a better future for our children and a better future for our institutions, our schools, our museums, our accounting firms, because this ideology does not remain. It is a metastasizing cancer that will consume everything. If you think accounting is free from this, if you think tax rates are free from this ideology, wait until you find out that you get bumped a tax bracket because you're white. This is the kind of thing that is a destroyer of liberty. And what we want to do, and part of what this episode is warning people that this is not something to be embraced as a compassionate endeavor. This, we are trying to halt the growth of this cancer here in Canada. Andrew, do you have any last words before we sign off?
Yeah, if I could offer by way of application, right? I'm gonna get preachery for a bit and do three points, three steps. Okay. Number one, get your kids out of government schools. Number two, teach them yourselves so that you can unpack for them a robust and an accurate understanding of history, warts and all, and how to learn from it, so that step three, you can properly teach them and train them to build good, strong, and righteous things and cultures and institutions. And so you can teach your kids that they're not supposed to hide out while the world falls apart, and they're not supposed to climb into the shelter and then come out 75 years later when the nuclear fallout is evaded. But what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to bring all things under the lordship of Christ, understanding history, being taught properly. They're supposed to press and advance and build and take dominion. Go do that, but start by getting your kids out of government schools. Start there, teach them well, and then enable them to build for a future.
Love it. Thank you for joining us on Dispatch today. Join us later in the week and next week for more from the front lines of the Canadian culture war. Andrew, thanks again for taking up the show with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim.